Nice to see you in the morning instead of in the late afternoon. We are adjourning the meeting of the Joint Committee to Implement Measure 91 this June 18th. We're starting. We're commencing the meeting. It's too early, right? It turns out five is better. Let's get started with the meeting of the Joint Committee to Implement Measure 91 this June 18th. I'm going to address a couple of concerns I've heard and then give you a brief overview of our game plan for this morning. I want to start by, again, thanking you all for your hard work as we've gotten to where we are in the marijuana legislation. But I also want to note we've heard a couple of concerns expressed about the way the opt-in package has been, so the communities can choose to not participate in legal marijuana. And in response to that, I want to note that to those who feel this is a slippery slope, and gosh, maybe we're going to end up with the ability for communities to opt out of any statewide legislation or ballot measure that they don't prefer, I would say this. The distinguishing feature of legal marijuana is that it is still federally a controlled substance on Schedule 1. It's a federally illegal substance. And so we're in a very delicate situation in which local jurisdictions have, some of them, through their representatives and directly, have expressed some concern about being required to issue licenses or essentially authorize conduct that under federal law is still considered illegal. By allowing local communities to opt out of legal marijuana through votes or in some instances through direct action by city and county elected officials, we join the ranks of Colorado and Washington and enable communities that are choosing to not take that step. And in so doing, we're honoring the fact that this is a unique situation. It's still federally illegal, and we're helping dissuade communities that might otherwise be inclined to bring a legal action, potentially, as we've heard testified to in these meetings, seeking an injunction under federal law from having legal marijuana programs. And so in that way, it actually is protective of legal access more broadly, and it's unique and distinguishable from other state laws. So I think that that's important. Second, I've heard some concern about whether communities that have chosen to opt out will still be able to have tax revenue from legal marijuana sales. I want to clarify some misunderstandings that I've seen in the community. One, you may be aware that the local option point of sale tax is only available to communities that have not chosen to opt out of any legal category of marijuana. That includes medical categories for which that's an option, and all of the Measure 91 adult use. So none of that local option revenue goes to a community that's opted out. In addition, under Measure 91, after the initial distribution, Measure 91 sales revenue is only allocated based on licensees. And furthermore, we have an amendment that would clarify that if you opt out of any of the legal categories of marijuana, you're not eligible, your community is not eligible for Measure 91 revenue distribution. So to those who say, gosh, communities are going to not be having legal marijuana and yet getting tax revenue, I'd say, actually, no, that's not the intention. Third point before we move into the public hearing is access. You know, it wasn't my first choice to end up with the opt-out structure that we ended up in, but I did accept it, and under access, there are some safeguards. There is a strong grandfather clause for existing marijuana businesses, even for communities that opt out. Very significantly, you cannot opt out of medical grows. I don't know that everyone knows that. You can't opt out of caregiver processing and caregiver delivery. So even in communities that opt out of marijuana, existing legal facilities get to stay. And also, there is no option to opt out of medical grows and caregiver processing and delivery of medicine. So those are some protections. I know it's not everybody's favorite outcome on 3400, but in the practical world in which we have to work together to enable legislation to happen and the good parts of the legislation to happen, I feel like this is an appropriate outcome. So now I'm going to give you a quick overview of what we're doing, and then we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 844. we're nearing the end of the legislative session. I think you all realize that. And so the measures that we can, the amendments and the bills that we can pass at this point are informed by that. There are some good ideas on the table, and not all of them are going to be ready to be put into bills that we can pass this session. So I want to flag for you that if your idea, it doesn't end up in an amendment, it doesn't end up in a bill that we can pass, you know, in the next couple of weeks, that doesn't mean it's dead forever. Hopefully we come back as this group, reconvene in the short session and can have more of these conversations. But please know that, you know, some ideas on which there's not broad consensus are not going to be ready to go this session. That doesn't mean you can't bring them again and we can't work them together again. All right, with that, let's open the public hearing on Senate Bill 844. I'm going to invite Senator Chris Edwards, is he here? Yes, he is, to come forward and discuss first an amendment that he is interested in us considering. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I learned a little bit about 3400 listening to you explain some of the aspects of it. My name is Chris Edwards. I'm state senator from Eugene and Junction City. And today I bring to you the Dash 36 amendment to Senate Bill 844. This comes from the, it was previously Senate Bill 480, the Dash 1 amendment, which created the Task Force on Medical Research. We took that amendment. We talked with other stakeholders. We talked with agencies involved and have worked out something that I think meets the needs of more folks. It increases the scope of focus from just medical research to medical and public health and safety research. And the it's a fairly simple amendment. It specifies the membership of the task force and then what the task force shall do. Things like identifying the legal barriers to the establishment of laboratories, identifying the legal barriers to the use of institutional review boards in approving, monitoring, reviewing research involving medical properties of cannabis, and things like this. So there are a number of legal questions that need to be answered, and I think we need a forum to get all the right minds and knowledge in the same room to hammer out some potential legislation for the next legislative session to bring forward to really guide us in how we can move some critical research forward in the state of Oregon. I know that it is late in session, and I know that you have a lot of work to do. I've been impressed, frankly, by what you've been able to do thus far on a really contentious issue. And so I will be just that brief, and I'm happy to answer any questions about it, but that's what the amendment does.
Thank you. Have we got any questions on Senator Courtney?
Madam Chair. Yes. For those in the audience who are a little perplexed by the wardrobe selections today, this is actually Peter Courtney Day. It's Senator Courtney's birthday, and we all try to look as much like him as we can.
Those of us that remember. I forgot.
So, Madam Chair, I just want to point out that sometimes a mistake leads to a better outcome, and it's certainly my intention to get the task force notion into the omnibus bill. That didn't happen. But what happened instead is Senator Edwards, to his great credit, worked with some of the other stakeholders to make it an even better task force proposal. I have met with Lynn Saxton, the director of OHA, and she assures me that they can get the task force going and do it very quickly, get a work product out very quickly. And I think it's really so important. Over and over, we've heard testimony where the question arises, wait a minute, what does the research show? Oh, excuse me, there is no research because it's been an illegal substance. So I want to thank Senator Edwards for bringing this forward in an actually better form than we had it before.
Yeah. Thank
you. Senator
Przewanski. Just following up with Madam Co-Chair just said, I'm just warning, I guess, clarity as to the task force. My understanding what Senator Edwards is putting together is one that would be more legislative driven as compared to an agency-driven task force?
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Przanski, membership is actually, so the membership would include OLCC, Oregon Health Authority, OHSU, a representative from OUS, the DOJ, and then members with expertise in agricultural research, microbiology, substance abuse treatment, neurology, oncology, palliative care. And so it is, I would not characterize it as a legislatively driven, I mean, well, legislators and the president of the Senate shall appoint one Senate member, and the House, the Speaker shall appoint a House member.
Two follow-ups.
Please.
First of all, who do they report to? And second, I guess my concern is that if it's an agency-driven task force as compared to one that's a legislative-driven task force, we may not have the balance that we want. I'm not sure what Madam Co-Chair has just said as to what Lynn Saxon says that they're willing to put together. I don't know if that means this particular task force that's being called out or if she's talking about creating her own
within the
agency.
This particular task force,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah, and they would be reporting to the legislature by February.
Right. And
so
who's
short duration.
And I guess the other part is who's staffing it?
OHA.
Okay.
Okay, any other questions for Senator Edwards? Thank you very
Thank
much
you
for coming
for
in.
Your consideration.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right, so now I'm going to open up additionally a hearing on House Bill 2041, but I want to give you a little more context before we do that. First, let's open the hearing on House Bill 21. I'm going to call Mazen Malik. But, sir, before you come up, I'm going to just say a couple of broader things. So we have essentially three more bill vehicles that we may consider during the course of this session. 844, as you've heard, potentially has in it the element of the task force. There is an expungement amendment that could go in there. There's been talk about the early start, which back a while ago we noted might potentially go in 844, and some technical fixes might go in 844. House Bill 2041 is intended to include the tax point of sale change from point of harvest to point of sale, and also clarification potentially that at no point, if your jurisdiction opts out of a form of legal marijuana, you cannot get any of the Measure 91 revenues. House Bill 2040 would potentially include the tax element of an early start, because you can't have that in a Senate bill.
Madam Chair, I think what we discussed was having the whole early start concept in 2040, the tax element plus
both elements,
the
okay.
substance of it. I believe that's what we came up with.
There's a fair amount of motion and quite a number of amendments, if you've been looking at OLIS lately. And so I'm trying to give you a little bit of a guide in terms of where people feel like they are in terms of what will happen next. So at this point, we're going to welcome up Mazen to talk about his work on tax matters, and then we have a sign-up list for 844. If anyone wants to talk about any of the other bills, please go ahead and sign your name up. Good morning.
Morning, Co-Chair Dunninger, Chair Burdick. Last time I was here, I promised you that I would be trying to get some of the answers that you were asking about how does the tax rate that you've looked at, which is 17% on a point of sale, would compare to our estimates in the Measure 91. Okay, and I think in addition to these two pieces that we have in front of you, I also asked Adam, and I know he put the original Measure 91 estimate documents on all us as well, in order to be able to have it as a point of reference. So just quickly to tell you the overall picture that you have. In Measure 91 estimates, we had the base year, and here the base year is just basically saying a base year is the base of would it be any year where you implement. So this is a full year without any restrictions or problems. So when you have at the top, you would have it primarily that top line says if you have it at that base year, you should be looking about $28.6 million of revenue compared to a 21 that we were looking at with Measure 91. Now, what happened is you obviously picked up a few million dollars in the base year, and the way that occurred is because you went into a different structure of the tax from upfront to the end. The outcome of this would have been is to remove the multiplication or the multiplier effect of the tax being in the beginning and the roll-up and the markup system, and ended up taxing at the end. Which happened is basically you dropped the price for the consumer at the end and end up picking up about 5% of market share as a result. So that's result number one that you have. And remember last time when we talked, we said the legal market will probably never be able to completely outtake the illegal market or the gray market on price. But the competition is on the safety of the product, the security of buying, and also on the quality of the product. Those are points of primarily competition, which also means that the legal market, every time you have improved these, the variability in their price becomes smaller because they can't charge a high price for somebody who doesn't know because they could go and get it from the legal market. Now, that is one point. The other point that you also changed the revenue came primarily from the introduction of the tax on edibles and extracts and so on. These were not explicitly part of the formula in the Measure 91 because they were supposed to be. This was a harvest tax in Measure 91, so whatever was processed would have filtered down. Now you've introduced a product with its own tax system. We were able to estimate how many units based on reference from both Washington and Colorado and what they're looking at, and get the general average price of that, and in those you were able to pick up about $2.6 million because of the edibles and the extracts in addition. So part of that amount of money. furthermore, you have about the people coming back from what would be the Washington market, and in addition, having more of commuter traffic and so on, we get about 10.5% increase from the base use for that, but that was also included before. So primarily both these the edibles, the moving of the price down, basically was able to increase that amount of revenue that you were looking at. Now, the lower and upper range, those have to deal with populations and the 95% confidence rate that we estimated, as you would see if in your original document of Measure 91. So, in essence, what we're saying, your revenue could be as low as $23 million and as high as about $34 million. In any one basic year. Then if you want to step down the document, we take that $28 million and we apply it to where the initial start of the process or the legal market is, and that would be assumed here to be the beginning of 2017. And that will also, with the implementation, usual difficulties and half year, will give you to about 10.7 million. So that's the first line you would see. So that would be about 38% of what you should expect in a base year. Then we start applying costs, and the costs here you have two things going on in the costs. And just to quickly go back, on the Measure 91 estimate, that number was 16 million. So you actually lost on the net, I mean, on the amounts that is, although you've gained on the top, you lost because of the implementation date changes here. So this 10 million, the implementation is a little higher costs, it seems, but however, a lot of the cost is assumed to be recovered through fees and so on. So you get about to a total of about 4.57 or 4.6 million in 2017. The distribution as you have it, 40, 20, 15, 10%, 10%, and 5. So the net amount coming to 2017 will be still about 4.7 distributed to these different ways. Then in your coming biennium 2018 and 2019, that changes, and it is about a $10 million a year increase from Measure 91 estimates because of the same reasons that we've talked about. So you get it to about 20. On the net revenue amounts, you get about 29.3 or 29.4 million and 31.0 to a biennium of 61.4. That's your basically new estimate based on the new way of taxation. The distributions also is in the bottom box to all these different years. So you have 3 years, which is the first fiscal year, 2017, is what would be left out of the 15-17 biennium. The fiscal year 18-19 will be the 17-19 biennium. So those are the quick estimates and the quick reasons behind the differences. If you want to compare them to what we had in Measure 91, this would be in the report of Measure 91 on page 14 of that original report, in case you want a reference point. And additionally, we also had a forecast for future possible growth, assuming different levels, because this market is still not very not very solid. There is a lot of unknowns in it, and there might be a lot of risks that might enter into this process. There is, depending, of course, how we end up with who's doing what at what time, and how you establish this market, and how you establish the control. If we ever be able to establish what we call the profit-maximizing monopolistic price or not, that kind of thing might give you a different outcome. But here's what we put here in front of you are different assumptions of how the legal market expands and how it starts taking more hold into the whole market. So you could, the best scenario, that is the, tell me what color is this, small? Or that color. Bluish. The one way up high is about $60 million dollars on the upswing by 2022. That is the as everything goes right. If everything goes right as we estimate, we still think there is growth in this market regardless. So, but the lowest amount is the about. 35, 36 million by 2022. So that's in general the base of what we have for you. This is the general idea. Every other amendment that you would have probably will have a little different things. Of course, one of the things that we included here as part of this estimate is you also lost about 3.5-4% because of the exclusion on big swaths of the state because of the opt-out provisions. That is because what you're doing is you're leaving a big amount of the population to continue with the black market mechanism rather than emerge to a legal market. And at the same time, I mean, you still benefit from it because, you know, some people would still get the legal market, but mostly the construct that you leave is a black market mechanism.
Thank you. Do you have a question,
Chair? Madam Chair, I do. This is all very interesting, but I think what we're trying to get at is two metrics. One is, how does the revenue compare to what would be raised in 91, and how would the resulting price? I'm interested in your idea that with the grower tax, you actually had a greater increase in price because it's marked up along the way with the tax in the base, whereas point of sale, you're only taxing at the end, so you only have one impact of the taxation.
Right.
So we're trying, as a committee, we're trying to determine how we want to stay close to 91, both in terms of revenue raised and in the effect on the price of their marijuana. So with those two metrics in mind, can you give us some guidance on that?
Sure. Co-chair Burdick, as I said, the one-to-one comparison to measure 91 of this, first of all, of this page, you would have on page 14 on the measure 91 report. So on the gross level, basically you picked up revenue. However, for the year 2017, because of several factors, factor number one is you have a different start date. In Measure 91, we were assuming 1/1/2016. This is a different start date here is in 2017 or some other time. So it was assumed to be earlier. This is later. The startup and collection costs are higher for 2017. So in the gross levels, you are looking at a higher amount of revenue, and that higher amount of revenue for the year 2017 in the net process is actually lower than what we were expecting in Measure 91 because of these factors. Now, back to why are we expecting more revenue in general out of this discussion is, as you were saying, the price... the price factor, and you could also go to Measure 91 and the document and go to page 10 and 11, and you would see the different permutations that we did on assuming where the price effects are, and primarily the effects of federal tax on 280E implications and at which point it implies. Now, remember, this allows or does not allow you to take the cost of doing business. And if you start first with a tax as a producer and then you add all of these things up and then you have your legal business in the sense that you're paying your insurance cost, you're paying your security, you're paying your computers, you're paying your unemployment taxes, you're paying all these things, and then the price, the tax, you end up with a price that you're going to pass to the next stage, and the next stage takes it, and then same thing happens, and they pass it to the next stage. So that's how the price...
Yeah, let me just
please.
Break in here.
Please.
We're trying to determine, because Measure 91 was billed for the voters with raising a certain amount of revenue for specific causes, for education, for local governments, and so on. So we're trying to get a sense on is this be close to what Measure 91, after you consider all the factors, would it come close to raising the amount of revenue for those purposes that the original Measure 91 would have done?
After the year 2017, it'll be a little higher.
A little higher.
Yes.
And
overall amount is about $10 million a year.
Overall amount. Now, is that your pinpoint amount, or does that?
That's a pinpoint amount. That's
okay, so it has
the point
range.
Estimate rather than the range.
Right. And
yes.
So how does the range compare to what the range was in?
That's about moves about in the same way. So.
Okay.
So in general, you just picked up because of the different structure of what you had in the tax system.
Okay,
you
and then
the
second question is, how would it compare to 91 on its impact on the price of the product?
The price of the product will be lower to the consumer because of that. So you're looking instead of about $300 an ounce, you're looking at about what we have here is, excuse me, about $277. So that's
the price to the consumer would be lower than under Measure 91, but the revenue would be a little higher.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions about this? Okay, I have a question. You know, so I was involved with the effort to pass Measure 91, and I know that when the Department of Revenue issued, or the, I'm not sure exactly what entity issues the revenue projections for ballot measure.
State Revenue Office would be the one that is statutory.
So those are the projections that you're citing to as you compare your estimated revenue range to what the measure estimated, correct?
Yes. Revenue estimate that you have in the document that you have in OLIS, yes.
So the point that I'm trying to make is that I recall that a lot of the advocates for Measure 91 felt that the revenue estimate from the state was actually significantly below what had been the Eco Northwest revenue estimate and perhaps a Harvard revenue estimate also. So what I'm hearing you say, and I don't have a dog in the fight in terms of where I want this point of sale tax to be, except for that I want it to be comparable to what people estimated Measure 91 would generate. But what I'm hearing you say is that it is in the range of what the state, it's on the higher end, but it's in the range of what the state estimated on behalf of when it was assessing Measure 91 could be the amount received by the state, but that interestingly was actually on the quite low end of the perceived range by the advocacy community of what folks thought might be generated. So it's an interesting situation where from what I'm hearing you say, and I need to study the materials more, it sounds like we are fairly within the range of what people reasonably expected. I also feel like you just said that the cost for consumers is slightly lower than what the estimate was. And you said 270 as compared to 300?
Yes. Madam Chair, co-chair, sorry. Let me say it this way. The estimates, there were a range of estimates. Not all estimates looked at how things actually happened. Let me say, in our estimates, we followed a model of how business actually passes costs,
mm-hmm.
and how these things are built in the way of doing business. I did not see anybody else do that. Now, having said that, if these new way of taxing, and that's why you have taxation experts, because the way you tax affects your business. if taxes didn't matter, I guess we probably would not be looking at it. So if these estimates of the other advocates would have looked at this, I'm sure they would be a lot higher now. Mm-hmm. So that it is probably not that we're emerging to a point, but basically we're having a different way of how we looked at things.
So I have one follow-up question, and maybe Coach Burdick, you do. A strong concern for me is that we remain significantly under what has been described as quite high tax rates in the Colorado adult use and the Washington adult use market. Are you in a position right now to be able to compare the aggregate difference in tax amount were we to go with this 17% plus a 3% local option as compared to Colorado and Washington's aggregate as applied tax amount?
Yes, Coach Ealing, the way Colorado taxes, it starts with 15% on not the retail, but the distribution.
Okay.
So there's your first 15%, which has to fold in the price.
But I'm looking for the aggregate number as much as
and
possible.
And the aggregate number, and that's and that carries into the price, which is makes the price higher to start with. Then they have 10% and 2.9%, and then the additional local. So they have 12.9 or 13%. After the 15%. So and that makes the 15% increase is probably twice as much. So this is equivalent to what we would say, leave the $35 that we have in Measure 91 and then put a 17% on it. So that is what we are significantly lower.
All right.
So the state of Washington goes 25% on three levels, which is, as you know, when they multiply, it's a lot more than 75%. Because, so we are by far probably the lowest.
Okay, even if we were to go 17% plus the local option of
3. We would probably need to go to about 35 to 40% before we become comparable.
And I just want to be clear that I do not support that.
Yes.
I'm
just answering your question.
Yes, yes. No, I don't hear you advocating for that either. Do you have any questions?
Well, no, I think we're considerably less than what Washington's just recently done up there in their legislation. At 37%, I think we're heading the right direction right now.
Uh-huh. I was taking a look at the measure language this morning and noticed that, so at 17%, that's keyed for inflation, but the measure language actually is, while you think about the $35 per ounce of flour and you think, oh, maybe that's a fixed amount, and 30 years from now it'll be 35 for a much higher price per ounce of flour, but it's also keyed to inflation. So the fact that this is keyed to inflation does not distinguish it in some radical way. Yes, sir. Yeah,
thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Yeah, I think it's very instructive that a number of members of this legislative body are getting an opportunity to be schooled in the business of retail for the first time, discovering that tax rates always matter. And the cost of doing business always relates to the price of the product. And so I hope that that's a lesson that more members of this body will take to heart as we consider how to allow other businesses to be successful in Oregon.
Thank you for that.
Well,
perhaps you'll consider offering radio station internships to give us a firsthand.
Well, the okay, legislative revenue will be willing to
do a radio station internship. Okay. All right. So I think that I'm not seeing any additional questions, but thank you. That was a great comment. And with that, we'll thank you for your presentation and start moving into the public comment part, the public hearing part of this. I'm going to also open a public hearing on 2040. We have that scheduled. Which is the potential vehicle for early start. So that if folks are signed up and they want to speak to a range of issues, you have the convenience of being able to do that. We have about 45 minutes. Senator Przanski.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I understand that the co-chairs have looked at 2040 as being the potential for early start. I'm going to throw out, I think there's another option. That's the Senate Bill 844. I believe that we should actually bifurcate the tax issue from the early start. We need to get the starting going forward, and then the taxes are going to catch up with it. And so I would be telling individuals when we're looking at this that we're not, at least from my perspective, looking only as 2040 as the early start mechanism to get us there.
Thank you. I think that's a fair point. And you have an amendment in 844 that sets forth that position.
It has part of what I want. It has a little bit extra that I don't want.
Okay.
Ms. Madam Chair,
sure.
I think it would make more sense to keep it all in House Bill 2040, and I'll have a side discussion with you, Senator Pruszynski. There are some other factors involved.
Okay, so surprisingly, we have a difference of opinion among members of the Measure 91 Committee. What? So that the audience knows, one of the reasons why tax issues for an early start would not be in Senate Bill 844 is because you can't have taxes imposed in a vehicle that starts in the Senate, and because it's a Senate bill, it would start in the Senate. So you can only do taxes in House bills. It's kind of interesting. So you'd either bifurcate or you'd do it all in a House bill. All right. First up on our list, we have Dennis Morgan and Sam Chapman and Donald Morse. Hi.
Good morning.
Whomever would like to start, please introduce yourself for the record and let us know what you think.
My name is Dennis Morgan. I'm a board member of the Oregon Environmental Laboratory Association. Also, my wife and I are major shareholders of Environmental Laboratory, Water Testing Laboratory down in Eugene, Oregon. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Environmental Laboratory Association with addressing some issues in House Bill 3400 and in some possible glitches, and so talking about in House Bill 844, I believe it is, to address those. And part of the issue in talking with, we are controlled by Oregon Health Authority. We test, you know, all water, environmental water, and the Oregon Health Authority is who our accreditation agency is, and that's who the you guys intend to have accredit the marijuana labs. But because of the bifurcation, there's a little bit of confusion between, at least from the Oregon Health Authority group, as to who's doing what. So I was hoping to have you folks, you know, basically, and maybe it'll be in part of the task force committee, but to have the agencies work together, because right at the moment in talking with the Oregon Health Control, the Oregon Health Authority, ORLAP, there is a lack of communication going on between the folks. And so that creates some issues in terms of the practical implementation of dealing with that. Also, I also have a number of years in the pesticide business. We're talking about testing pesticides on marijuana in terms of going forward. As a laboratory, we like to know what we're looking for. The open deal of going out and testing for all sorts of different things virtually makes it impossible and very expensive.
Right.
There's a couple ways of doing that you might also take up or push forward, and that is, one, having the Oregon Department of Agriculture create what's called special local needs under FRFRA for labels for use on marijuana, so then growers can use those labels and we can know what to go test for, and make things much more cost-effective. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. I appreciate that. Mr. Chapman, welcome.
Co-chairs, committee members, my name is Sam Chapman for the record, and I'm wearing two hats today. The first one is for the Cannabis Genetics Preservation Society, and the other is my own firm, New Economy Consulting. I'll be representing the clients that I have that are in retail on that side. The main issue that I have in terms of the Cannabis Genetics Preservation Society is that of seeds, and that seeds have kind of been, to my delight, a non-controversial issue, as I expect they will continue to be non-controversial. But I had noticed that in all of the early sales language across the board, seeds were not included. I suspect that was something that was just overlooked. Again, because they haven't been controversial, there hasn't been a whole lot of talk about seeds specifically outside of breeder conversations. And so I just wanted to put it before the committee that I'd heavily encourage you, if we do go forward with recreational sales, early recreational sales, sales that we include seeds. I really don't see a reason not to. They don't have, they're not going to need the same type of due diligence periods that maybe edibles and extracts are going to require because of labeling and packaging. Okay. So I'd very heavily encourage you to add seeds. The second point being that Oregon has a very vast amount of rare genetics here in the state. And I've heard a lot of talk about, you know, the future expectation of being able to eventually export the best quality products of Oregon elsewhere. And I think that the best way that you can preserve these genetics is not by cloning and continuing to clone. Eventually, you break down the genetics of a plant when you continue to clone it. But from a seed, you have real genetics that can last longer, will last longer in time in general. And so that's something that's very important that I want to put forth. The other issue that I just wanted to raise was just my support for early recreational sales in general. I think you're going to hear a lot of people talk about how, and there may be agreement already here in the committee, that, you know, in order to really avoid any black eyes in terms of, you know, say it being legal to possess and grow, but we have nowhere to buy it, you know, we'll hear a lot about, you know, this is going to help us be in line with the Cole memo. I agree with that. I think the more important local point that may resonate with this committee is that if we truly want to keep this industry a craft industry and we want to empower the mom and pop small businesses to be able to survive in this industry, we need to have early recreational sales. I can tell you right now, as a consultant in the industry that works with dispensaries, existing dispensaries and new dispensaries, that they're hurting right now. If you're in, if you're one of the 130 some odd dispensaries in Portland, you are struggling to stay open if you're not one of the top 5% of dispensaries that have the capital to do marketing, the resources for all of these products that people need, you know, the staffing, just the overhead in general. A lot of these businesses are starting to drown and either sell out to larger big business that is not local, and that can, unfortunately, in some instances, circumvent residency laws, that we need to give local residents and existing businesses as much of a leg up on the existing and future competition that we will see in the state of Oregon. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you very much. I'm going to let Mr. Morris testify first, and then we'll have an opportunity for questions. I want to note that with the number of people we have on the sign-up list, it would be great if people could keep their comments to about 3 minutes, and that way we'll be able to get through to everyone by 10. Welcome, Mr. Morris.
Thank you, chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Donald Morris, and I'm here representing the Oregon Cannabis Business Council. Mm-hmm. I, too, would like to offer my support for early sales. On Tuesday, we held a meeting of all of our dispensary members, and overwhelmingly, they supported the early start. The main reason that we discussed is that we feel that medical dispensaries are going to be put in a precarious position. We anticipate that the number of medical patients who will come in and get marijuana that they will then turn around and get, sell to their friends, basically, is going to be huge. That by not starting soon with under 91 and making marijuana available to those who want it retail, we're putting those people in a precarious position. Do they go to the park and get it, or do they find a friend who has a card and, you know, OLCC calls it shoulder tapping or whatever. But however, that medicine is going to get to these people one way or another. And rather than putting them in a position where they may be breaking the law, I think it's in the best interest of everyone that we give them a means to obtain the marijuana as soon as possible. We do have a few concerns about, you know, the July 1 date. That's only a few weeks away. To ramp that up is going to take a lot of effort on a lot of people's parts. We realize that. But at any rate, the sooner we can do this, the better. And there were just a few other things, if you will indulge me. There are a few items that pertain to medical patients that have were supposed to be in a patient's bill of rights, and they've kind of wallowed. And if it's at all possible to see these amended into this bill, we would very much appreciate it. The first one would be from HB 2821, Section 6, that doctors shall not refuse to prescribe medicines or treatment plans because a patient has a card or uses medical marijuana. If this made its way, treatment would include the transplant list so that people could not be refused to be put on an organ donor list if they're using medical marijuana. The other would be HB 2821, page 2, lines 26 to 30, allowing patients in hospice to be administered cannabis by those other than their caregiver. You know, the caregiver can't be there 24/7. These people are dying. They've chosen to use cannabis rather than opiates. Rather than force people into breaking the law on behalf of these dying patients, we need to put some language in there that lets them take care of these people. And the last one would be HB 2821, page 4, section 2, I believe subsection 4, which is lifetime card for chronic or terminal disease. Glaucoma isn't going to go away. Why do people have to go every year to the doctor, spend the money, spend the money on a card? If you just want them to renew the card, fine. But to jump through all the other hoops is kind of ridiculous. An amputee with phantom pain syndrome, that they're not going to grow back their leg. It's going to be there the rest of their lives. So all of this paperwork is a tremendous waste of resources. And we'd like you to think about that and put some language in there. And that concludes. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Representative Wilson?
Yeah, just a quick one. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, to Mr. Morgan on the subject of lab testing. Are you familiar with the story in the Oregonian over the weekend about pesticides in medical marijuana?
No, I wasn't. I happened to be in Yellowstone Park over the weekend.
Ah, very fortunate. Wish I had been, too. Just briefly, the Oregonian had quite an expose on setting out to search for pesticides in medical marijuana product, and they seem to have struck gold there, claiming to have found a tremendous amount of pesticides in medical marijuana in their test. They seem to know what to look for. They seem to know what they were going after in that particular case. Are you asking for direction from OHA on specific pesticides that they'd like you to look for, or how do you interpret that?
In the accreditation procedure, the particular analyte that you're looking for, i.e. the pesticide, is part of the accreditation procedure that we go through with ORLAP. We just don't magically go out and say, you're going to run a GCMS, and whatever you get is fine. We actually have 34, 48 particular analytes that are part of that accreditation procedure. I mean, I presented OHA with a list of 64 most common used pesticides that are used on marijuana that has been developed nationally. So it's not so much that we don't know what to look for, but it's more in terms of when I came back and asked for the SLNs for the Department of Ag, that allowed. Well, currently, it's a violation of federal law, the FRIFRA law, to use pesticides on marijuana for anything. And so by getting the SLN, you take that off the grower and off the Department of Ag. It also gives us things specific to look for, and that's part of the accreditation procedure. We can go look. I mean, if we are not going to allow, if we're going to allow 30 of the 64 possible uses, then that limits what the labs have to look for.
Thank you. I want to note also that our expectation is that there will be rulemaking that fleshes out what the more specific elements are. And so rather than us identify and set in stone in statute exactly what contaminants to be looked for during the lab testing process, we delegated that to rulemaking. And I trust that, like OLCC, they'll convene a bunch of stakeholders to get appropriate feedback. And hopefully, sir, you'll be able to join them. I'm going to actually thank the panel now and keep moving so that we can get all of our folks in. Next up, we have Jeff Sugarman, Megan Wallstatter, and Matt Wallstatter. And again, if we could have you each keep your comments to 3 minutes, that would be ideal.
Good morning, co-chairs Leininger and Burdick. Jeff Sugarman with the Oregon Cannabis PAC. Just a couple of issues I want to touch on today. First, I wanted to express the Cannabis PAC's strong support for the Dash 36 amendments and the research task force that Senator Edwards has proposed. We think it's critically important work as we move forward. We think we can be leaders in the nation and in the world in developing this research, and we would encourage that inclusion, the inclusion of that amendment in the bill. The second part I want to talk about is early sales. I brought with me today Megan and Matt Wallstetter, who are the owners of the Pure Green Dispensary. And just before I turn it over to them, I think that one of the things that we will benefit from with this early sales experience is that we may find some things that as we go through the rulemaking process that pop out as we start working our way through this process. We believe that the tax should be set at the same level that we're going to use for recreational sales. We still have questions about how that tax is being set, but at this point we would just assume that it should be the same level. And thirdly, I think you'll hear more testimony about this from some other folks, but I do see a provision in the bill that requires the dispensary to keep the name of every single customer that that they bring in, and we think that that's a little bit overburdensome, and we should be dealing with this just like we do with beer and wine and alcohol sales. They need to keep track of those sales. They can do that very easily, but I don't think it's required that they should keep a list of name of people who come in there. And the final thing I'd say is that we saw some information out of Vancouver, Washington recently, where they're saying as much as up to 50% of their sales are coming from Oregon customers, and they're bringing that back across the border. We should be taking advantage of that market right now. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Megan and Matt, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Co-chairs Leininger, Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Matt Wallstetter. I am the owner of Pure Green and also a member of the Oregon Cannabis PAC. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. We're medical growers, dispensary owners, members of the PAC. Our business is a small family-owned firm that currently employs 10 Oregonians in living wage jobs. We're eager to participate in the new system for recreational cannabis and to be licensed, tracked, inspected, and generally held accountable for our work. We're here today to urge you to support the early start of recreational sales. This plan makes sense for a number of reasons. First and foremost, it will help shrink the black market, a top priority as we implement legalization and sale of recreational cannabis. When cannabis becomes legal on July 1, Oregon will have hundreds of thousands of consumers with no outlet to buy any marijuana products. If we fail to provide them with safe licensed outlets to purchase these products, they will not simply wait until OLCC stores open on September 1, 2016, assuming they open by then. Many will head north to Washington, and I was going to cite the same Oregonian article that Jeff just mentioned. 50% of sales are coming from Oregonians. That's tax revenue that we could be keeping here in the state. Others will turn to black market growers and sellers who will happily provide what they need. This will give black market growers a greater foothold in the industry and make it harder to dislodge them once the legal sales begin. It will also incentivize black market growers to remain in the black market instead of encouraging them to join the new legal marketplace. That's the demand side of the argument. There's a supply side argument as well. We know many cannabis growers who would like to participate in the legal system. Unfortunately, we produce significantly more cannabis in Oregon than we can legally transfer and consume under the OMMP. This means growers without access to dispensaries are left with the choice of either selling their product illegally or otherwise just letting it go to waste. And so it's neither a secret nor a surprise that a great deal of that product winds up diverted out of state. As you all know, out-of-state diversion was one of the top federal enforcement priorities listed in the Cole memo, and anything we can do to minimize it will help keep the federal government out of Oregon's business.
Thank you, Mr. Wallstetter.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, it's nice to see you all. Megan Wallstetter, I'm here to continue our letter. By opening recreational sales earlier, we'll provide a legal outlet for all of that cannabis. It can be legally sold to Oregonians instead of illegally sold in other states. This will bring a vast number of growers into the legal cannabis system, further choking off the black market. Many small family cannabis farmers who want to enter the legal marketplace are daunted by the task of compliance. SB 844 would open access to the legal market while easing these growers into the regulated system. This would help more of these craft growers who compromise the backbone of Oregon's emergence industry to make this transition. Beginning legal recreational sales in 2015 will also help protect Oregon businesses. We currently have more than 300 dispensaries in Oregon with scores more licensed pending. These shops are currently serving the same 70,000 patients that were being served by a year ago by 70 retail stores. We don't know of a single dispensary that is doing well or thriving in this oversaturated market. With so many more dispensaries coming online in the near future, the situation will only worsen. In fact, we know several shops that have closed or will close shortly because of these conditions, and this means the end of many Oregon businesses and the living wages jobs that they create. Opening recreational sales early would throw us a much-needed lifeline. We know that it is a priority of this legislature to make sure Oregonians participate in this industry and to make certain that the majority of these jobs and revenue generated in this nascent market remain in Oregon. By starting recreational sales at Oregon medical shops, we ensure that the first group of recreational businesses are locally owned, operated, and staffed. We may find that these shops can adequately serve all of our state's cannabis needs, in which case we will have built a uniquely Oregonian industry. Some patients and medical marijuana activists have expressed concerns that we would have an inadequate supply of cannabis to serve both the medical and recreational markets. As a spouse of a patient who requires medical cannabis daily to be able to eat, we understand these concerns. We believe, however, they are misplaced. Oregon produces more cannabis than it consumes. Even if we found that demand outpaced the supply of indoor cannabis, the outdoor harvest season begins in October, and we would have access to all of these products by early November. This would keep most of Oregon's sun-grown cannabis in Oregon and continue to fuel those local economies. We understand the challenges that you face in implementing the new legal cannabis market. We appreciate your efforts thus far. Matt and I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have, and we've attached our contact information to our testimony for your review. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Any questions? All right, that was very helpful. Thank you. Next up, we have Casey Hallinan, David McNichol, and Bo Whitney, please. And on deck, we have Lucas Littlefield, Kimberly McCullough, and Pete Kramer, please. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Casey Houlihan. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Retailers of Cannabis Association. We are a group of retail cannabis businesses, predominantly dispensary owners, but also manufacturers of edibles and value-added goods, folks that are entirely reliant on a robust retail marketplace. Firstly, we'd like to thank all the members of the committee for their hard work thus far tackling this very complex issue and some of the nuances that come with it. We're very content with some of the compromises that we've seen come out of this committee thus far, and obviously very content with the framework that you guys have put forward for recreational sale moving forward, which allows this issue of the early sale to even be possible. We are firm advocates of allowing for the early sale period. We think that it is a critical piece to completing this this work that we've put together in implementing legalization. A report by the Brookings Institute in 2014 had identified six major factors in Colorado that led to their successful rollout, and thus far we followed largely all of those guidelines, including seed-to-sale tracking, including tight guardrails on supply, and really the only missing piece that we have yet to follow is the piece where we allow the existing medical marijuana dispensaries or businesses to have access to the market as we begin to expand it into the adult use sector. We've looked at the three different proposals, the two amendments to 844, as well as the dash threes to 2040. We think all of them would create a solid framework for moving forward with an interim sales period. We are fonder thus far of the language in the dash threes to 2040 that have the measure going into effect on the 91st day after the passage. We've been collecting a lot of data from our members thus far, and they seem to be on the same of the same opinion that we could get started as soon as we are given the nod from the legislature, but that at this point, in order to ensure a smooth rollout, October 1st or sometime around there would be much easier to comply with if they were given that directive. With that, I'll keep my comments brief because I just otherwise like to echo the sentiments of a lot of the other folks that have already spoken. We understand the urgency for making sure that we can get these sales online as soon as possible to prevent fortifying the black market and to divert as much supply away from leaving the state as we can. And I think everybody's on the same page on that. We've already spoken with many of you about that particular issue. So with that, I will leave it to the rest of the folks on the panel and take any questions you may have.
Thanks very much. I'm going to ask everyone to speak, and then we'll invite questions. Please, go ahead.
Madam Co-Chairs, committee members, it's good to see you again. My name is David McNichol. I'm the owner of Dave's Space Cakes, a board member of the Oregon Retailers of Cannabis Association, and I'm on the OLCC Rules Advisory Subcommittee for Edibles. The Oregon Retailers of Cannabis Association represents over 40 Oregon-owned businesses consisting of dispensaries, processors, and businesses related to the retail sale of cannabis in the state of Oregon. It is the opinion of our board, our members, and myself that we support Senate Bill 844-37 or House Bill 2040-3 and have plans and procedures in place to handle a successful implementation of an interim limited marijuana retail product sales period through the current OHA-licensed dispensaries. On July 1st, every adult in this state will have the right to possess marijuana, and our member businesses can provide them a safe, secure, and trusted access point, just like they have been doing for medical card-holding Oregonians for the past 15 months under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Dispensary Program. As the owner of Dave's Space Cakes, an edible processing company, my products will be excluded from limited marijuana retail product sales. However, I know that the only thing we can do as an emerging industry is move forward. Measure 91 goes live 2 weeks from today, regardless if any of us are ready. But it's not about us. It's about the citizens of this state who are relying on this industry to provide them with these products. And we are relying on you, the members of this committee, to provide us with an effective avenue to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, Mr. Whitney.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Bo Whitney. I represent Greenpoint, Oregon. I'm here before you today to propose two amendments. One's associated with Senate Bill 844. The proposed amendment clarifies the grandfather date for medical growers who opt in on recreational. It proposes that the date be set and defined as the day in which the person submits the opt-in application with the OLCC. It's just an eight-word amendment, so I'm hoping that you'd consider that proposal. The second amendment is associated with House Bill 2040. The proposed amendment is to add CO2-based extracted oils to recreational sales allowed to be sold in 2015. It adds to the definition of limited marijuana retail product the newly defined class of products described as marijuana extract by itself. There's some technical aspects of what CO2-based extracted oils is defined as in 3400 and others, and so that just kind of clarifies that a little bit. And just for your information, the reason I'm proposing this, and it also, the proposal limits the sale to 3.5 grams per day to any individual. The purpose of this amendment is to highlight the fact that extracted oils make up 50% of the total market, and this would help address the issues of diversion into the black market. It would also provide OLCC with valuable data in the interim as they go through the rules-making process on in terms of the market demand. And it would also, essentially allow for, like I said before, to take as much of the excess supply off the illegal market. Okay. So I hope that you'll consider my proposal.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Does anyone have questions about that? I actually have a question, Mr. Whitney, about the eight-word change on the opt-in. Can you describe for us the effect of how it would change the status quo?
Well,
it's
not necessarily clear when the date where plant limits are is set. There's a transition period between, say, January 1st, 2016 and March 1st, 2016. And so it's not really clearly defined. And so this would set a date, a line of demarcation for the date that the application is submitted to the OLCC.
Okay. Thank you.
Those are
important thoughts. Anyone else? All right. Well, thank you for being here today and for your input, all of you, as we move forward. Next up, I'd like to invite Lucas Littlefield, Kimberly McCullough, and Pete Kramer as our last three folks we have lined up for today.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I just have a few comments. As far as the early sales go, 844-37 and 2040-3, both, as Mr. Sugarman already pointed out, they require dispensaries to keep track of the name of a person that sales are made to. We're just concerned that this is going to scare people away from going to dispensaries and buying products, having their privacy essentially put at risk, and having their names kept. A record of that is probably going to make people a little bit concerned. We think it should just be treated the same way that it's going to be treated under the retail sales when the retail stores are up and running, and or if just the same as when you go and buy liquor from a liquor store. Also, there was mention earlier of the Patient Bill of Rights, and if there's any possibility of getting those into one of these bills, we would also support that. And then I just wanted to point out with 844-38, the expungement provisions, most certainly we support any sort of early expungement, and the one-year expungement is something that is certainly better than three. One of the things that I did notice about that, though, is that it requires that a person not have committed any other offense. And my guess is that the reason that that's there is to pick up a situation where somebody committed a marijuana offense at the same time as they committed some other offense. But the way that it's written, it would also apply if, say, for example, 5 years before they had committed some other offense, or, you know, maybe they were involved in some sort of assault that was totally and completely unrelated to the marijuana offense. And so my suggestion would just be that there be some language that makes it clear that this is supposed to pick up that situation where they committed a marijuana offense at the same time as they did something else, or that was related to something else, so that it doesn't depend on something that's completely unrelated. So those are just my comments. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now it's your turn.
Madam Co-Chair, as members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chris Littlefield. I am a member of MX Biotech, an applied cannabis research company in Eugene, Oregon, as well as a member of the Subcommittee on Labeling and Advertising. I wanted to strongly support, along with our 4,100 patient plus base, adding the -36 amendments to Senate Bill 844. The research is very important, as you all have heard me testify before and speak individually. We need the research to happen, and I truly believe, as well as the company behind me, believe that this task force is a key to the success of adding research to the forward movement of marijuana, both recreational and medical. We need folks involved in research. We need folks with backgrounds and other backgrounds involved in the research of cannabis, and this task force is a vehicle that will get us there very, very quickly. We feel that the OHA oversight is important. We feel that communication with these different groups is also very important. So I'm going to keep my comments very brief today and say thank you all very, very much for all the work that you've put in. We, the community of Oregon, really do appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm Pete Kramer from Mercy TV. Thank you for doing all the work and figuring things out. I'm a medical grower, a medical patient. We went through a lot of years without having safe access for the patients to get their cannabis. I'm glad that 91 came so the general public can get their cannabis. And they won't go through the particular situations finding the cannabis because it wasn't around. There wasn't any safe access. The research on the cannabis is important because we need to know if the cannabis is safe. Not overexposed to different drugs. Thank you. I could go on forever, I guess, but I appreciate your listening to us.
Thank you very much. Does anyone have questions for this panel? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just a quick question for Kimberly. I was visiting a close friend in his dispensary the other day, and I noticed that I had to sign in upon going in. Where does that come from?
All right. So my understanding is under the medical program that when people are buying the medical product, that they're having to go in and verify. You know, they have to provide their card and show their identification so that they can verify that they're part of the program. And that's why that's how they're getting access. I'm not sure about them asking for your identification when you went in as well. That seems a little bit odd to me. Maybe that's just something that dispensary decided to do. I don't know of any requirement under law.
Yeah, if I might clarify, I didn't have to show any ID or anything. Oh, okay. I just simply had to sign in.
Oh, you had to sign in. Yeah, I would guess that was just something that they did on their own. But as far as, you know, people that go to the liquor store and so on, they don't have to, and they won't have to under the retail stores. So, yeah.
Okay. So we are 10 minutes from our finish date, and, you know, since we're at a new time and we're toward the end of session and Ways and Means Committees are meeting, people have had to come in and out. I'd like to invite members of the committee to make any comments, particularly Representative Buckley, who has not been able to be in part of the meeting, and I'm seeing that Senator Przanski has a question.
It's not a question. It's more of a statement.
Please.
I don't have the time. I understand Co-Chair Burdick is going to talk to me offline. But I do want to put this online.
Please do.
The Dash 37 is not something I specifically asked for, but it is a framework of what I want to work with. I truly do believe that we need to have the early start on time, as Senator Farioli has said, on July 1. By having it separated out, it does not have an automatic 90-day wait, because if it's a tax bill, it has to have the 91 days. And to me, if we as a state can't, and we don't have our act together, to begin collecting a tax immediately, it's just something that we bear the cost of that. And at some point, when we have the mechanisms to do that, then the taxing can begin. I agree. As when I looked at the Dash 37s, I would be wanting to remove on page 2, lines 5 through 19. That's the requirement for recording and potentially reporting individuals that are coming for rec sales. As we've just talked about, that is not required under Measure 91, and there's no reason to have that extra burden on the individual dispensaries to collect. It doesn't show any purpose or need for that. The other part regarding on page 2 of that amendment, lines 20 through 23, talks about a city or county being able to adopt prohibiting retail sales at a dispensary. As much as I wish that that didn't occur, if it occurs, we clearly need to ensure that those entities, meaning the counties and cities, do not receive any tax revenue from any sales that are occurring. And as far as I'm concerned, the initial money that's supposed to be going out under 91 should also be prohibited if they've enacted a ban on these type of sales or on the medical or anywhere else at that point. Lastly, as Sam Chapman said, I also agree that the seeds should be able to be sold. We did talk about that previously, and it does look like it was an oversight. But clearly at this point, it seems to me that if we're really going to abide by the Cole memo, we need to ensure that we take every reasonable step to stop black market sales and diverting individuals that is going to have the legality to possess after July 1 by having as early a start as we can. And from what I would say is that we pass the legislation that states on July 1 and forward that a dispensary who chooses to do so that's not prohibited by a city or county from doing so will be able to start on their time frame, and then we'll get the tax in place and we'll start having the tax assessed upon time period.
Thank you. I want to note in affirmation of, but also in response to your comment about making sure that the initial distribution intended under Measure 91 would also not go to communities that had chosen to opt out, part of the language of the current, the most current amendment to 2041 does make that expressly clear. So you've got support in that.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to clarify. I think there's a difference between a community that decides not to go for early sales, a community that decides to wait for the permanent, and I wouldn't want those communities that stay in the system for the permanent program to be deprived of the ability to share in the tax revenue.
Right.
So they're two separate things, and right. I'm completely in agreement that they don't get any taxes from the temporary. But if they decide to just wait.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay. I think we're all in agreement on that.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the amendment language contemplates, that only if you opt out of the long-term.
Correct.
Senator Farioli, I know that you're thinking about early starts. Would you like to make a closing comment?
On time start, Madam Chair.
and by that you mean?
July 1.
Well, if July 1 is possible, and I concur with my colleague, Senator Brzozinski, if we aren't able to start the tax collection July 1, then we should forego that revenue until such time as the statutes are and rules are in place later. The other issue is I agree with the comment earlier about collecting names of the purchasers. I'm not sure that comports very well with the idea that a person could possess up to 8 ounces. You could buy limited quantities for a limited period of time under a soft start or the on-time start for recreational. But the only purpose, I think, for tracking names is a holdover from the medical marijuana registry requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Because only limited quantities of limited product would be available in the soft start, it makes no sense if a person has the ability to possess up to 8 ounces in 4 plants and so on and so forth to worry about their names if they want to scurry back and forth from one dispensary to another. You know, that may be one way of touring the craft outlets of the state of Oregon, but I'm not really worried about the quantity issue. The Cole Memorandum talks about a well-regulated system for tracking revenue, not purchasers. So, you know, unless somebody makes a very strong argument that there's a technical problem, I don't necessarily see the need for collecting the names of purchasers.
Okay, it sounds like there's a pretty strong emerging consensus on that. Thank you. Any comments from my left here? Okay, so my understanding is that we do not yet have the paperwork to move on 2041, which again is the changing the sales from point of harvest to point of sale, and hopefully we will have that by Tuesday. As you can see, we're also working on the possibility of some changes to the work that we've done so far through 844 and potentially also through 2040. One of which might be the vehicle for doing an early start slash soft start slash on time start, depending on how you look at it. And if you have additional comments, I know that there are some issues that were raised today, like whether edibles come in, whether concentrates come in to a soft start. There have been questions raised about patients' bill of rights, you know, really very good suggestions about patients' bill of rights and access to cards for veterans. And what we're doing is trying to work through as many of those that we feel like we can get past this session as possible. And for anything that's not quite ripe in terms of consensus to move forward this session or broad support to move forward this session, We want to keep working on and talking about, because there are a lot of good ideas out there, whether or not we can in the next couple of weeks put them into a bill that passes. So thank you. Co-Chair Burdick, any word about our Tuesday next meeting?
Things are approaching the end, so Tuesday could be a busy day.
Right then. So go to sleep early that night, and now I will really close the public hearings and also adjourn the meeting. Thanks. the public hearings and also adjourn the meeting. Thanks.